It's a fun story. Jesus feeding the 5,000. And it's the gospel reading that we were assigned for this week. If you have one of these little March cards that goes through the text that we're reading for the week, it has Exodus 16, the psalm I read for the call to worship, a New Testament in Galatians, and our gospel, John chapter 6, 1 to 15. We're going to look at here, John chapter 6, 1 to 15. I'm not being silly. I did notice for the first time they picked up leftover bread. They did not pick up leftover fish. So I don't know if it was just cooked really well or people made sure they got their protein and didn't want as many carbs. But what's that? The fish wouldn't keep. That's true, yeah. The other thing that's interesting about this story is this miracle is in all four of the Gospels, which doesn't happen very often. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all record a story about Jesus feeding people from one lunch in the wilderness, five loaves and the two fishes. So you get the feeling that this story really made an impression. It was one that nobody forgot and everybody included. And it might be because there were so many people that saw it happen. If this story is circulating and Matthew, who was there and is retelling it, and John, who was there, is retelling it, then it stands to reason that many of the people who ate the food are still alive when it's being read. Isn't that interesting to think about? That when Matthew is circulating his story about this time that he spent with Jesus of Nazareth, and he includes the story of the feeding of 5,000, that as it's passed around among the Jewish diaspora in Jerusalem and Samaria, right around the area, people might be reading the story of Matthew or this Matthew's story of his time with Jesus and go, "Oh my gosh, I was there for that. Healed my kid, and then I ate the food, and there was more bread than I could handle. So I just left a little extra on the ground. I didn't know they had 12 baskets left. That's amazing." And so it's reasonable to me that this story is included in all four Gospels because it involves so many people that there would be a lot of collective memory about that day. Let's look at it here in John. The other thing that's interesting, right? The first verse, it says here, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Most of the context of this occurs, and I said maybe 2 weeks ago that these Gospels are written in this like Greek form, the bios style, which these early first and second century Greek styles telling the story of people's life are less interested in a comprehensive chronological accounting of facts and more interested in aligning stories about a person's life in order to communicate some truth about them. It's not as though the stories are not true. The stories are true, but the author makes choices about how they are arranged and which stories to include in order to communicate something true about the person. And so Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are writing these Greek forms called bios in order to communicate a truth about Jesus of Nazareth. And it's a little bit nuanced and different for each of them, which is why they don't all include the same stories or even in the same order. But the reason that I bring that up is that it's interesting. In almost every occurrence, each of the four times when they talk about the story of the feeding of the 5,000, it starts with Jesus trying to get away from some folks. Because he is tired. And so he goes off to the wilderness. You know, in one, he's like, he's just crossed the Sea of Galilee to get away. And they run around and meet him and mark. And in John, he says it this way. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him. Definitely a large crowd. 5,000 families. Like, ruins the grass behind them when they're walking, right? Like, I mean, that's like a herd of people. And a large crowd was following him because they saw signs that he was doing the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain and there sat down with his disciples. He got away to the wilderness, up onto the mountain, and the Passover is approaching, so he sits down with his disciples and they're going to have this time together. It is worth noting that there are a couple of times in the life of Jesus where he has this big crowd. Remember when he's going down into Jerusalem? We'll get to Palm Sunday in a couple of weeks. But he's got a big enough crowd that it takes notice. As he's moving, he heals Lazarus, then comes down through Jericho, picks up blind Bartimaeus, and goes into the triumphal entry where it's enough that it feels like a parade. At this place, he's got 5,000 families following behind him. Jesus is making a name for himself by this point in the story. He has the 12, and then around the 12, like the Marys, and there's a sort of a larger kind of cadre of people. But then this, like, these people are, like, really after him. We'll see at the end of the story, they want to make him a king. And I just, we don't always think about Jesus that way, so I just want to point it out. It's not like some pastoral scene where he's got a few people and he's feeding them. This is 5,000 families marching out into the wilderness to try and find him. I don't know what 5,000 families looks like even walking, really. But that's a mess of people. And a large crowd was following because they saw the sign that he was doing on the sick. Now, Passover feast of the Jews was at hand, and lifting up his eyes, then seeing a large crowd was coming toward him. He looks up and it's like, here's the 5,000 families. And Jesus said to Philip, hey, where are we to buy some bread so that these people may eat? He said this to tempt him, for he himself knew what he would do. John gives us that little insight. I don't know how he knew that. Maybe Jesus told him later. Verse 7, Philip answered him, Jesus, man, 200 denarii would not buy enough bread for each of them to eat just a little. And one of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, hey, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?
I wonder, like, you know, Andrew is known for kind of being like the evangelist. He's the one that goes to get his brother Peter. Look, I have met the one Jesus. Andrew seems to have this thing where he's quick to be of faith. It's like kind of a thing about him. And he wants to bring other people along. And so I wonder if he knew that the meal was to no avail, wouldn't do anything, why even bring it up, you know? And so it seems almost like Andrew's is willing to be in a position that Jesus may know something that he doesn't. And right there is the beginning of faith. Jesus might know something that Andrew doesn't. And that's a hard one for us to take in. Like, certainly Andrew knew there's no way you're going to feed 5,000 families on one little boy's lunch. Also, how did the kid have lunch? Like, certainly a mom packed that lunch for him. Right? Like, and was his mom not there? Like, did she not pack a lunch for herself as well, just for the kid? It's just interesting to me that of all those families, we've got one little kid's lunch. I like to think that he came by himself and his mom stayed home because she had some sense. There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many? And Jesus said, have the people sit down. And now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, and about 5,000 in number. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to them, those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told the disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. And so they gathered them up,
and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves. See? Left by those who had been eaten.
See? Just the loaves were left over. No fish.
When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Okay, what's interesting in John's account is that nobody tells Jesus to send everybody away. You see that? Lifting up his eyes, he said to Philip, "Where do we buy bread for these people?" And he said this to test him, for he knew what he would do. And Philip answered, "We don't have enough money, man. We can't do it." And one of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 loaves," and Jesus takes over from there. So they don't even have a reasonable answer. In a couple of the other accounts, they're like, "Jesus, you got to send these people away." Actually, the disciples come to Jesus in a couple of the other accounts and say, "Hey, it's getting to be dinner time. You got to send these people away so they can eat, man. You got to come up with a reasonable solution to solve this problem," right? In this one, Jesus jumps to the punch. He sees him coming and he says, "Hey, Philip, what do you want to do?" And Philip says, "I got no clue, man. There's no way we have enough money to solve this problem." And Andrew's like, "I don't have a clue either, but here's this little thing. This guy has 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Maybe we could eat." Maybe he's thinking that. Right? And then the next part, they're in a tough spot because Jesus prays for the 5 loaves and 2 fishes and then gives it. And I do think 2 fish split between 12 people, that's a fish in 6 parts, goes out to each of the 12. You get a 6th of a fish, and he tells you to go pass it out. And that's an awkward moment for a minute. It's interesting that Jesus still makes the disciples go through this process. Certainly, he could have formed a buffet line, or he could have just miraculously moved the food out to the people. But he goes through this mechanism of making the disciples break off a piece of bread and give it to the, "You want some more? Okay." He said to give them as much as they want, and they just keep passing it out. And at some point, I wonder, when do they go? At some point, the disciples go, they got to start to get giddy, right? And then they just start throwing the bread. I mean, at some point, you got to go, I can't believe this, and see if you can get ahead of it, you know? You're passing out faster, 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 faster. So what does it do to the disciples to experience the unexpected provision of God in that way? I think it's later they forget it, you know? But I love that. I love to try and imagine the experience of that, and you can see why Jesus might make them go through that. And the thing for me, there's a lot we could take from this story, you know, and I think that there's something in offering that food for Andrew. But the thing I want to think about is that idea that maybe Andrew recognizes that Jesus knew something that he didn't. The Old Testament reading that they gave us for today is Exodus chapter 16. And if you want, you could look there, but I'm just going to tell you the Cliff's Notes version of it. They're out in Exodus. Remember, God has miraculously delivered them from the strongest military power of the day. They've been slaves for 200 years. They lived in Egypt for 200 years before that. So they have 400 years of identity of being foreigners in a foreign land. And they have a vague notion that before they came into Egypt, that they had a God of their own. And then that vague notion comes into the person of Moses, who then defeats all the Egyptian gods, walks them out of Egypt. Actually, Egyptians start to come with them. They give them spoils from their house. They give riches from Egypt, and they leave. And then he defeats Pharaoh's army. They walk across the Red Sea miraculously. They're on their way to Sinai.
And already, before they even get to Mount Sinai to meet with God, to have God speak to them, shake the mountain and His manifest presence come down into earth as it hasn't been since the time of the first ones in the Garden of Eden, they're already crabbing, right? And they crab over and over again. And this in Exodus 16 is before the Ten Commandments are given. So before Exodus 19, where they meet with God on Sinai. And in the 15, and the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness, like Jesus is out in the wilderness in John's Gospel. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, where we sat by meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." The whole people, some people debate how many, but over a million people wandering seemingly in a legitimate desert are worried about where they're going to get food. I just want you to see it's a reasonable posture to take. They're hungry. Where does food come from? But for the fact that they've seen the miraculous provision of God, they might, like Andrew, take the posture that maybe God knows something that I don't know. Maybe God has some idea that I don't have a grasp on yet. Maybe there's some notion that God has planned for me that I don't approach griping merely with my own solutions. A reasonable, rational solution is we're out here in the desert and going to die. Egypt knows how to make food. Let's go back there. Maybe now that we've shown them what's up and we killed their army, we can develop some kind of reciprocal relationship. We'll still make the things. They'll feed us. That's a reasonable strategy. But God knows something Israel doesn't. Something Israel doesn't. Sometimes I have this relationship with my children, Ellie's sitting right here. We're about to go somewhere, and I have in my head that it's going to be good for them where we're going. Maybe I know that we're going on a place they're less excited about, so we'll stop and get an ice cream, right? But I don't want to talk all about it because maybe I'll change my mind depending on their behavior. Or maybe we won't go by the place, or maybe it'll be closed. But I have in my mind a thing that she doesn't know. We're getting in the car, and then the children are crabbing, and I wish they would just have patience and trust. And I have a situation for them set aside. You can see God bringing His people through, and He's just delivered them, and He's taking them to Sinai. A defining act for their people, the presence of God, a description of life with Him. Setting them aside as a treasure, and they're worried about the meat pots in Egypt. And He's like, "Y'all, I know something you don't know." So there in the wilderness, in response to their griping, though probably planned anyway, He has meat fall from the sky. And in the morning. When I started to think about this story of a whole nation of people thriving in the desert, water coming from rocks, a bread falling in the morning, meat in the evening. I thought, man, when you are the people of God, there are times where the rules of the world just don't apply. One little kid's lunch is enough for 5,000 families. When you're the people of God, sometimes the rules of the world just don't apply. For God knows something more than you. And then it becomes like trying to figure out, when do you make a choice for faith? I just wonder if the 5,000 families walking out into the desert, what they thought they were going to do about food. They didn't know what they were going to do about food, right? Like, they know what time it is. They know how far away from things they are. But you know what? Dude, this guy Jesus is here. Did you see the things He's doing for the sick? Food can wait. Food can figure itself out. There's some kind of like blind faith That's good. If they had gone home and had food when it was time, they look at the watch to see where they are, they start to reason to go, we should probably head back. That would be fine. They wouldn't be excluded from being people of God. The death and resurrection of Christ would still count for them, just because they went home to have dinner instead of eating the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes. But bummer for them, they would have missed the miracle of Jesus. Right? Forever. They would hear the story, they'd be like, oh my gosh. I mean, I had a full meal at home, but... And there are times all through the story of Scripture where that happens, where you see people making choices. And sometimes it turns out amazing. The one I was thinking about, I heard this week in a little podcast I was listening to, was when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego go down into the flames. Remember? When Nebuchadnezzar gives them a choice. Bow to me or burn in the fiery furnace. They're like, look, we think our God will deliver us from your fiery furnace, but even if he doesn't, we'd rather burn than bow to you. Right there's a choice. God knows something we don't know. Right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego know, if I go in the fiery furnace, I burn and die. But God knows something I don't know. What comes after death? What comes through the fire? So they go down into the fire. Right? That's not like, God knows something I don't know. I'm going to go with God on this one. Right? And it's clear. And the Egyptians stay and get the bread. The other one I was thinking about is, remember the story of Stephen, the first martyr in the church? Stephen is preaching all over Jerusalem and causing problems for the Jewish church. So they pull him in from a trial and they go, hey, word is, you're disrupting things by preaching the way of Jesus. Is that true? Stephen knows these dudes are angry. And according to their words, they can stone him to death. And he has a choice. They can say, you know, it's not true. I haven't been preaching the gospel of Jesus. It's not something I'd like to stake my life on. I'm going to go back over here. In that case, he could end up repenting of that and be fine. Live his life. But Stephen says, no, it is true. Preaches the gospel. And how does it turn out for him? Boy dies anyway. Right? He bets on Jesus. He dies anyway. He gets the vision of Jesus sitting at the right hand and forgives his accusers just like Jesus and gets welcomed into the hands of Jesus, but he dies anyway. I'm just saying, we make choices of faith and it doesn't always go the way we want. But in every instance, God knows something we don't know. Look at this, how the Gospel of John ends, or this Gospel reading ends. John's the only one who includes this little part. So they gathered him up in 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. And when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed a prophet who has come into the world. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. You know, maybe you remember the story about the devil offering Jesus all the kingdoms of the world, and he turns down the devil. But these are Israelites, man. These are like the people who are supposed to like him. And they are like, they would like to make him king. And Jesus walks away from that. It reminds me when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane. Same situation. Where the reasonable choice would be to make a deal and get out of the situation in the Garden of Gethsemane. The reasonable choice would be to take these Israelites, okay, let's do it. I'm supposed to be a king anyway, let's set up a king, we'll get Herod out of the way, then I'll figure out some deal with Pilate, and then maybe we can put together a team and take over Rome, right? And he doesn't. There's this posture that God knows something. God has a plan, and he's going to bet on the plan of God. And this is the opportunity for us yet today. volunteers we have on earth, is to find ways, places, spaces, times, choices, to bet on the way of God. To approach some positions, some forks in the road, some decisions, as though God knows something that we do not. There have been multiple little turns and corners in my life where I realized the reasonable choice would be fine. It would be fine for me to get to the wilderness, see it's dinner time, and go home and get some dinner. And the food would be great. All right. But there are also times where there is an invitation to keep pressing on and following Jesus. Past what I know. Past my own reason and capabilities. To look at 5,000 families and go, look, I don't know what to do, but I got this little bit here. Maybe you know something I don't know, Jesus. Take my little bit and go, hey, what are we going to do with this? I'm saying there are opportunities you have, large and small decisions, where if you want, you can bet on God. And you never know. He may feed 5,000 people. It doesn't take a lot for God to show up and do miraculous things. Just a little lunch. And those opportunities don't go away just because it's no longer the first century. You and I still have opportunities to see God work. It's just so easy to pick the reasonable choice. But every once in a while, maybe, and on the idea that God knows something that you do not. Bet on the idea that God's way might open up a miraculous happening, opportunity. Well, let's pray that we could be people of faith. Hey, Lord, thanks for this story and for doing it in front of so many people. And then for not choosing the way of the people, but the way of our God. Turning down that kingship. Good Lord, open up our hearts of faith this morning, our spirit. Give us eyes to see the places where we could be faithful with just a few things and keep expanding those opportunities that we might end up being people who are faithful with much. Ask it in Jesus' name and for his sake.